Well, since this is the last lecture in this series, can I thank everyone for coming and say how pleased I am that so many people have turned out for them. Basically, it's much more fun giving lectures than listening to them, so I do appreciate you coming. What I'm going to talk about has some relevance to the question that was just asked from the audience here, the fate of politics in the world in which we find ourselves at the end of the 20th century. Now, I think that the world in which we do find ourselves, you can designate as a culture of endings. We live in a culture of endings in the sense in which intellectual culture, and I think the social sciences in general, have been preoccupied with the theme of endings for something like the past 20 or so years. We have, of course, the theme of the end of socialism, the end of communism, the end of history, Francis Fukuyama. A book was recently written called The End of Science. There's been books written called The End of Work, The End of the Family, The End of the Nation State. I'd actually defy you to find any institution, a significant social or economic institution, of which someone hasn't recently written that it's come to an end. There seems to be a culture of endings without beginnings. It's a culture dominated intellectually, it lasts at least for the past few years, by two strands of thought which I want to distance myself from. On the level of culture, postmodernism, I haven't talked about postmodernism directly in these lectures, but it is, in many respects, probably the dominant theme of cultural analysis of the past 20 or so years. And on the level of economic theory, neoliberalism, which I'll be talking about in this lecture directly, which is a theory of how the world is and what are the forces shaping that world. I would take it these are two of the dominant themes, really, of the culture of endings. Now, one doesn't know this for sure, but I think the culture of endings does reflect a certain period of history itself. That is, it does reflect the close of the century and the close of the millennium. I think, and I would like, I suppose, actively to promote a culture of beginnings, because I think there will be a change in the zeitgeist, there will be a change in the intellectual and cultural orientation of the West. With the beginning of the new century and the new millennium. It will, I think, be a more engaged form of social and political cultural thought. It will be more positive. It will have a message of hope, and it will address the world society. If we ask not just what is ending here, because lots of things are ending in our lives, I mean, this is a very big period of transition in global society. But if we ask what's beginning, I think we know what is beginning, and I've tried to sketch out some of the contours of this in these lectures. What is beginning is something like a global cosmopolitan society whose institutions we don't yet fully understand. We live, as the sociologist Martin Allbrow also threatened to come to this lecture somewhere, but I can't see him. Of course, there he is. Cause the global age. We don't yet understand, I think, what are the driving forces and possibilities of this society. But a global cosmopolitan society, which affects our everyday lives as well as world institutions, I think is being shaped before our very eyes. It is not a postmodern society. This emerging world society is still largely driven by the great forces of modernity, as I tried to stress in these lectures. It's driven by the expansion of science and technology, now globalized, with technological change becoming more intense with every passing year, certainly in some sectors. It is driven by the expansion of capitalism, the kind of dominant force of modernity, now itself becoming universalized, for better or for worse, across the world. And thirdly, it is driven by the ideals of mass democracy being the dominant political idea of the late 20th century, and globally influential, as I tried to show in a previous lecture. The emergence of this cosmopolitan society is not being shaped by human consciousness in the way in which Marx anticipated. This is not a world in which we can say, at least as yet, that we are becoming masters of our own history. It is not a world, if you go to the lectures later on this afternoon, they might say different, but for me it is not a world driven by dialectic, it is not a world governed by some immutable dialectic of history. It is a world of radical change, but where that change is not driven by a global political will. The changes are driven by the transformations I've also discussed in this lecture, these lectures. The impact of globalization, properly understood, globalization not being just the emergence of a global marketplace, but driven by global communication systems, electronic communication systems in particular. It's driven second by the emergence of the global weightless economy, an economy in which information technology is becoming increasingly the core force around which productive processes are grouped. It's being driven thirdly by global processes of detraditionalization, these altering people's everyday lives and shifting the status of tradition and custom. And fourthly, it's been driven by the increasing reflexivity of populations and institutions, where reflexivity means not a personal condition but a structural condition of living in an information society where enormous amounts of information have to be assimilated and in some sense responded to. The other side of that society, as I mentioned, two political possibilities: autonomy, wherever tradition evacuates any kind of context of action, there is the possibility of increased autonomy, or if you like, freedom. The other side, however, of this lapsed autonomy is compulsion or addiction. The rise of compulsiveness in our lives, I tried to show in the last lecture, is a fundamental feature, really, of lapsed autonomy in so many spheres of people's activities. This society, as Ulrich Beck says, is a risk society. The emerging global cosmopolitan society, because it's driven by us but not controlled by us, is a risk society in at least two senses. I don't think it's exactly what Ulrich says, but certainly I want to use the term. Two senses of this. One, it's a society which increasingly, because of breaking with tradition, lives in the future. The more you live in the future, the more you live in a culture of risk. Culture of risk develops when you try to take forward-looking actions. I mentioned in a previous lecture, for us the future in a sense has disappeared by our very preoccupation with it. Our only way of understanding our individual and collective futures is in terms of scenario thinking. Diversity of scenarios confront us, and no one can say normally which of these scenarios will actually be enacted. That's what it's like to live in a globalizing risk culture, where the concept of risk becomes fundamental both to our everyday lives and, as I'll be showing later on, to politics and other areas. Notice as one aspect of this, however, that risk is also an energizing mechanism. That the living in a global risk society does not mean simply seeking to manage risk or reduce risk. It does in lots of circumstances, for example, ecological risks, we need to do this. But risk is also an energizing mechanism of life. And this is true whether we like it or not. Risk is a key mechanism of the global information economy and especially of the financial sectors of that economy. Risk is also an energizing mechanism of everyday life. I think you can't take sensible decisions about your own life in respect of relationships, sexuality, the emotions, unless you're capable of thinking in risk terms, where taking risks is also a positive as well as a negative thing. This is what it's like to live in our world. A second aspect of a risk society is that we face new risks that no one, I think, has ever faced before. These are risks created, as I emphasized, by human involvement in our own history and by our own attempt technologically to master nature, which has rebounded on us. Of course, we have mastered nature in many areas, but we have created new risk environments for which there is very little historical precedent. Most of the ecological risks we face are new risk environments, but so are those to do with marriage and the family, because there's never been a society, I think, of our kind where you have very high divorce rates, but also very high remarriage rates. That kind of society is also new. That kind of risk environment is also new. We don't really know what the consequences will be for children and other people directly caught up in these changes. Characteristic of the new risk environments is that whether there is a risk or tool at all is normally debated. If you follow the global warming debate, for example, there's no way of proving, of course, that global warming is in fact occurring. All you can do is make a plausible case to that effect. But you will get plenty of people who will deny that it is happening. The BSE crisis is another example where you actually can't calculate the level of risk. So don't believe anyone who says the risk from eating beef is low. We simply don't know what the risk is. This destroys the age-old distinction between risk and uncertainty. That distinction becomes much more fuzzy in our times. This society, then, which is driven by capitalism, driven by markets, driven by technology, a lot more, probably, than by political will any longer, does pose for us the key question: what is the role of politics in this late modern world? Because among the endings widely discussed in the literature is the end of politics. You can find more than one book and certainly more than one article called The End of Politics, with the suggestion that politicians have become unimportant because they can't control the forces around them. The nation state has lost a great deal of its power to control its own destiny. And more generally, economic forces dominate so much, especially financial markets, dominate our lives so much, the whole realm of politics has become denuded of its significance for our lives. This is almost completely opposite, in a way, of what Marx anticipated, unless you think perhaps through to Marx's final communist society. It's almost the opposite. He did speak of the withering away of the state at a later stage, but he didn't mean a world out of control. He meant when we had a world in control. So it's a very different scenario from the one which we're facing. What are we to make of it? What kind of positive politics can you develop for the world? This is the subject of what I have to say in the rest of the lecture. Now, I think we do live in politics in a time of ideological endings. This is true. I think, and no doubt there were people in the audience who disagree with me, that we do have to accept not just the end of Marxism as a theory of history and as a way of grasping the future, but also the end of socialism. Where socialism, anyway, means something quite specific. The core driving dynamism of socialism was always that an organized, rationally controlled economy is both more efficient and more just than a market economy. That was the driving logic of all forms of socialism, both reformist and revolutionary, since at least the midpoint of the 19th century. This has proven not to be true. There is no way in which one can create a large-scale planned economy regularized by either government agencies or by human consciousness, which is as effective and as productive as a market system is. Again, for better or for worse, we live in a world where markets have triumphed and where at the moment there is no clear alternative to the capitalist global marketplace. It's a very, very fundamental and difficult thing, I think, to grapple with, but that is, I think, the world which we're faced with. What is alive in socialism? Well, what is alive, I think, are the ideals that drove socialists. I think we should still support those ideals. Those ideals include social justice, the attempt to eliminate poverty, the attempt to create peace, a world free from violence, and the attempt to create a world of solidarity where there's cohesion and cooperation between people. How can you make these values count, however, in a world which looks completely different, really, in many ways, from that which socialists anticipated? Fundamental problem that we must try to address, I think. A lot more could be said about the fate of socialism, but I think it's also important to signal another key ending, the death of conservatism. The death of socialism has been widely announced since the collapse of communism and the failure of Keynesian, or the coming to an end of the Keynesian welfare state. What hasn't been so obvious has been the crisis of conservatism, which is every bit as profound, and which is related to the crisis of socialism, I think, in a rather oblique rather than a direct way. Conservatism is collapsing. Conservatism has become incoherent, not just because of the collapse of socialism and communism, but because of the very fate of conservatism as an ideology over the past 20 or 30 years. What has happened to conservatism is that it has been taken over by free market philosophies. A free market philosophy, Thatcherism if you like, or Reaganism, I think you can regard shorthand term as market fundamentalism. Market fundamentalism holds that markets have a better solution to most of life's problems than any alternative institutions which can be invented, so that in as many spheres of life as one can, one should let markets rip. One should seek to expand the realm of markets as far as is conceivably possible, even into those areas of life which provide public goods, such as the health service or education. Put in brief, that's what market fundamentalism is. Conservatism, at least in many countries, many branches of conservatism, became taken over by neoliberalism. But what that did was to destroy conservatism as a coherent doctrine. Because you can't make a coherent doctrine by supporting economic libertarianism on the one hand and supporting moral authoritarianism on the other. What conservatives have wanted to do is to allow the market, which is the height of individualism, to flourish, but at the same time to defend the traditional nation. At the same time, even to defend the xenophobic nation. At the same time, to defend the traditional family. At the same time, to defend a quite morally strict and past form of these institutions. It's incompatible. It's not only ideologically incompatible, it's structurally incompatible, because the market destroys tradition. The most important de-traditionalizing force in the contemporary world is precisely market society. Market society driven by the forces of technological change, which I referred to earlier. The current problems, therefore, of the Conservative Party in this country are simply, I think, a local expression of the generic problems of conservatism worldwide. Conservatism has destroyed itself by taking over free market philosophies. To my mind, the only consistent free market philosophy is a wholly libertarian one, which embraces libertarianism in the moral sphere as well as in the market sphere. But conservatism does not have that. There are, of course, forms of, I think, quite worrying conservatism which have sprung up as a reaction, especially neo-right protectionism. Neo-right protectionism, unlike neoliberalism, is a consistent philosophy, I think. But it is a dangerous one. It's a consistent philosophy because it stresses protecting cultural values, but also protecting economic autonomy. It links hand in hand economic protectionism with cultural protectionism, often in a quite virulent way, in terms of opposing immigration, racist attitudes, and so on. It is a kind of consistent conservatism, but it is, I think, a dangerous one, left suspended on the right by the collapse of centrist or orthodox conservatism. Now, against this backdrop, what are we to do politically? What kind of political reconstruction could one have? Does it make any sense to say that the state, government, or more generally governance, still have a part to play in this runaway world? I think you must begin from asserting that they do. You must begin, I think it is an entirely defensible position, from the centrality of politics and the centrality of governance. Governance, I think, is different from government and certainly different from the nation state. Governance implies the generalization of mechanisms of government below the level of the nation state and above the level of the nation state, as well as at the level of the nation state itself. Why can't you do without governance? Well, you can't do without governance because only government can solve the question of the rivalries between different interest groups, different moralities, and different assertions of one's position. One of the things that's happening in politics, there are lots of special interest groups developing below the level of the nation state. Many, many special interest groups, like Greenpeace and many others. These are political groups. They have political objectives, sometimes laudable, in my view, sometimes not. But you cannot have a world which is run by special interest groups. You must have democratic government which allows one to sift out and assess the different claims made by such groups and other power groups in the world, including large-scale corporations and other powerful actors. Only government can do that. Therefore, there can be no end to politics. And what we should be looking for is an extension of governance rather than a reduction of governance. This would certainly set my position against neoliberalism. What the neoliberals want is a shrinkage of government. They want government to be reduced to a minimum. It just doesn't fit with the needs of the emerging world society. We need an expansion of governance, at least of democratic governance, across the world, and we want to see, I think, what the mechanisms of such governance can be, which I'll shortly go on to try to describe. Not only reconcilement of interests, but diverse interests, but the foundation of law and other key aspects of a civilized society are only possible through government, whether that government be at the nation-state level or at other levels. One of the great causes for hope for us, which goes back to the Iraq issue which was raised at the beginning, I think, is that we do live in a world where there is at least the possibility of the disappearance of large-scale organized war between nations. The state and government have always been war-making machines. Their war-making has sometimes been linked to democracy through the involvement of citizenship. You draft citizens for wars. It's at least plausible to suppose that the global cosmopolitan society is a globally interdependent society in which territoriality and the fighting of wars is going to become much more marginal than it's been in the past. There will be, and there are, horrific civil wars, but there is at least the possibility that there will be no more large-scale territorial war between nations. And in that sense, the culmination of the Iraq encounter, I would take to be a potential triumph of governance, that is, a potential landmark along the way to the United Nations becoming a more effective organization of governance within the global society and economy. If we take that as at least a plausible possibility, it does shift what kind of society we would try to bring into being. We do need to shift government away from territorial claims, from its association with violence, and from the old age-old connection with war, which is always one of the dominant motivations of the nation-state. We do live in a world where this is possible, I think. It's more than possible, it's quite likely, I think, that we can achieve this. But what shape will politics have? What kind of political program can we elaborate? I'd like just to list the following characteristics which I think are important. First, what we're looking for, or perhaps I should say what I'm looking for, is what I would call a second phase response to globalization. First phase response to globalization politically was neoliberalism. Neoliberalism, market fundamentalism, was both a response to globalization and an organizing medium of economic globalization. Privatization, the liberalization of the world economy, the emergence of unfettered free trade, these things did not happen naturally. They happened because of a general agreement between states, driven, I think, by the US above all, in which the impact of neoliberalism was strong, to marketize the global economy and to do so in such a way as to maximize free trade. That leaves us with the fundamental issue, the fundamental political issue we have to confront, is how can you create a society which is competitive within the global marketplace, but which still sustains the values which always drove socialists? How can you create a society which recognizes the exigencies of the global economy, because there is no way around those, I think, you have to face up to them, but at the same time is a society which respects norms of social justice, which fosters social solidarity, and which acknowledges that inequality should be combated. I would take this to be the fundamental political issue, really, or certainly a core political issue of the time. Second phase response to globalization wouldn't emphasize market fundamentalism. It would emphasize an extension of modes of governance, going right the way through from local to global governance in a way in which I'll come on to in a minute. Second, the new politics, for me anyway, is a politics beyond left and right. That's why I chose this as the title of a book I wrote a few years ago. Right and left will not disappear. Right and left are still important organizing divisions within politics. The difference between right and left can be fairly easily summed up, I think. If you're on the left, you believe that you should fight inequality, you should struggle to reduce inequality and to eliminate poverty. You believe that this goes along with the attempt to radicalize democracy. You treat democracy as a key political medium of attacking inequality and poverty. And you believe that government or governance is a fundamental element in achieving these ambitions. I would take it that's what being on the left means. In that sense, I would say, as an individual, I stand on the left. Those on the right would reject those presuppositions, I think. However, that having been said, it seems to me that many of the basic problems we face don't fit into that left-right division as described. That only touches upon some of the problems we face in constructing a decent and humane society across the world. There are a whole range of problems which I think stand beyond left and right, where if one tries to force them back into left-right divisions, you can't really resolve them. That's why I make a distinction, some of the things I've written, between a politics which does divide left and right, which I call emancipatory politics. Emancipatory politics is driven by the goal of emancipation, freedom from equality, freedom from unjust power systems, and so forth. And what I call life politics, which I think corresponds to different norms, different structural political strategies. Emancipatory politics is a politics of life chances. It's a politics of inequality, whether that be inequality of power or wealth. And it seeks to emancipate people from these inequalities. Life politics is not a politics of life chances, it's a politics of a detraditionalized world. Life politics is what you do after the end of tradition and nature. It therefore includes all questions of ecology and ecological risk. It includes most questions of local and personal politics. It includes the fundamental issue of how you respond to globalization itself. The ideal of constructing a global cosmopolitan society is not ipso facto the same as combating inequality, which is one part of it. Life politics therefore brings to the fore a new political agenda, I think, which needs not only new strategies but also new values to address. Chief among those values is cosmopolitan cooperation, I think. We need to contest fundamentalisms in all of their forms, whether it's religious fundamentalism or other forms of fundamentalism. We need to create a world society based upon a global cosmopolitan dialogue where talk replaces violence. These are the ambitions of what I'm calling life politics. I want to argue that on the level of national politics, on the level of local politics, and on the level of global politics, we have to address the interconnections between emancipatory and life politics. We can't force everything back into the old division between left and right, which only organizes certain areas of the overall terrain of politics. Thirdly, I think, if thirdly is the right number, the new framework of politics can be mobilized around three dimensions or three axes, I think. On each of them, whether you're talking about local government, national government, or global governance, we have to be prepared to rotate the axis a bit, to shift our relationship to these things. The first axis is the relationship between risk and security. The second axis is the relationship between individual and collective responsibility. And the third axis is the relationship between local political involvements and global political involvements. We have to construct a politics, as I would see it, which allows us to pinpoint a different mapping of how we stand in political policy making on these three dimensions. Let me just give an example of that, which is the future of the welfare state. Future of the welfare state is one of the core issues of contemporary politics and the future of welfare institutions more generally. How should we cope with that? Well, we should cope with it, I think, by recognizing that we need a positive, not a negative, critique of the welfare state. The neoliberal critique of the welfare state is a negative one. It saw the welfare state as the source of many our social ills, perversely, and it seeks to reduce welfare institutions as far as possible, to cut back on welfare. It won't do, I think. What we need is to reorganize the welfare state in a positive way so as to find a new relationship between risk and security, which in turn implies a new relationship between individual and collective responsibility. The old welfare state, I think, was based upon a notion of passive risk, more appropriate to a world where tradition and custom were still largely intact and where nature was still nature. We now live in a much more active risk environment. This is what an information society is like. In an active risk environment, you must have people who understand the nature of active risks, are prepared to take them, and have the resources to confront them. You must also recognize the positive aspect of risk. Someone who is mired into long-term unemployment, for example, might simply not be prepared to take the initiative or take the risk necessary to launch him or herself back into the labor market. We need, if you like, a society of risk takers, but we need, alongside that, mechanisms of security for when things go wrong. Those mechanisms of security have to be insurance mechanisms, mostly, I think, provided by the state rather than by private insurance companies. The state still has to be the insurer of last resort. If you think in terms of risk and security, you can see what it might be like to produce a more energetic economy, competitive economy in the world economy, but still one which provides protection and security for people. What you don't want is a welfare state which creates passive citizens driven into compulsive patterns of behavior. That is the opposite of the emancipatory possibilities of freeing from tradition. That also implies new attitudes towards responsibility. There must still be collective responsibility for risks that people face. There must be. This must be true of pensions and other areas too. At the same time, I feel there must also be education for individual responsibility and collective responsibility towards our futures. This is so if you consider the area of health, for example. Health used to be something just delivered by the healthcare system. You went to see a doctor if you got ill. But in a world where we know that how people live and how they relate to incoming information about lifestyle and medicine affects their future health, you can't have a passive health system like that, or at least it's dysfunctional to do so. You must connect individual responsibility for health with collective responsibility for healthcare and with ecological responsibility for toxic environmental health. All that has to have a forward-looking dimension, because in this generation we have to have responsibility for the world which is inherited by subsequent generations. It's a new mix of responsibility and initiative. The same thing applies in local global connections. If you think of what the European Union is, the European Union to me now is an example of a political tracking of globalization processes. It's an attempt to respond to the impact of a globalized world. And there are some aspects, for example, of welfare systems which will need to be promoted on a European rather than a national or local level. It gives one a kind of overall framework, really, for reconstruction of politics. By and large, around each of these dimensions, governance has to track globalization. Tried to stress before, globalization means three things. It lifts out of local contexts, economic and other relationships. At the same time, it pushes down and it creates new demands for regional autonomy and new possibilities of regional regeneration. At the same time, it squeezes sideways and it creates new economic regions and cultural areas. Governance must track this threefold movement. You can't do so simply on the level of the nation state. Therefore, national governance must be linked to a wider system of governance, which I'll come back to right at the very end of this lecture. Fifthly, or whatever the next point would be, I would promote this form of politics myself as a politics of what I call the radical centre, an idea which is another idea which has got me into a certain amount of trouble, which I think is a central notion. The idea of a radical centre is a perverse and paradoxical notion if it simply means being in the middle between left and right. That is what it used to mean in the past. That's what the centre used to mean. The centre used to mean a middle ground between left and right. If, however, you accept the argument that there are very basic political issues now beyond left and right, to be in the centre does not mean simply compromising. To be in the centre means building new political coalitions, which are not simply class coalitions, which might link, for example, the old and the young, might treat women as a major constituency. Where you build political coalitions of the centre, again, all the way through from local to global politics, but where you occupy the centre and you do radical things. Radicalism here does not mean being on the left. Radicalism means contemplating whatever policies are necessary to confront the massive political demands which we face. As an example of the radical centre, I would take ecological politics. We should be very radical, for example, in the way in which we approach the future of London. This is a city which does need radical rethinking in terms of transport, in terms of health, and in terms of urban management. But we can do so, I think, from the centre. That is, we can, I think, get enough groups together who do believe in such a vision to support it. This is a radical politics beyond left and right, and it makes for greater radicalism, I think, than if one simply identifies radicalism with being on the left, because you can easily see that the left can be conservative. The left, for example, can say, let's just stick what we have with what we have in the welfare state, because we've always had it. That kind of conservatism, I think, is inimical to the sort of thinking we need, really, in the late modern world. Sixthly, or whatever the next number would be, political programs today have to connect the local and the global. It's no good simply working on the national level. Particularly important, I think, is the politics of everyday life, which I discussed in the last lecture. What I call the democracy of the emotions, that is the intrusion of democratic mechanisms into family life, the creation of a global society where men and women are equal, this would be a major historical shift. There's been no bigger change in the 20th century, I think, than the increasing equalization between men and women. It's a process of genuine democratization, but it has to be understood as infrastructural democratization, linked through, of course, to national politics and beyond, but nevertheless located in everyday life. Emotional democracy is a core part of a resurgent civic culture, I think. No one should listen to stories about going back to the traditional family. We must build a family which starts from its first premise, that of sexual equality. And that means, again, thinking radically about the family in everyday life. Finally, what can we do on the level of global politics? Well, my view is that in a globalizing world, global politics becomes fundamental. The creation of systems of global governance is the task for the first two or three decades of the 21st century, and it is a realistic task, I think. There are basically three problems to be faced. I mean, there are more than three, but if I can mention three in particular, leaving aside ecological issues. First, global inequality, the existence of a fourth world, of permanent impoverishment, particularly pronounced in Africa, but also in some other sectors of other continents. Second, the furthering of instruments of global governance, the extension of democratic mechanisms through from local association right up to the United Nations and forms of global policy making. Both of these issues are difficult. The third is also difficult: control and regulation of financial markets. One of the results of the capitalization of world society has been the dominant position which financial markets have. Don't have time at the end of this lecture, of course, to discuss these issues in any detail, but let me suggest to you that all of them are issues in which we can and we will see political progress. All of them are issues about which we should have optimism and we should attempt political reconstruction. Starting with financial markets, the crisis in Southeast Asia has brought home to many people, I think, the irrationalities of a global financial market economy, as well as the changes that need to be introduced in it. What we should look for is a combination of global and local regulation of financial markets. Local regulation can happen through local best practice. For example, in Chile, what they've tried to do is to separate speculative capital from investment. So if you want to invest in Chile, you have to lodge a large amount of money with a central bank at zero interest for a year. The idea being that then you only get capital which is generally investment capital rather than currency speculation. Currency speculation must be, surely, more effectively regulated on a world level, and it is not by any means an ambition which is an unrealistic one, I think. We can't expect to see it happen. I think we should even be discussing the possibility of so-called Tobin tax. Some economists here will have heard of this, which also seems to me, contrary to what some people say, a possibility. Tobin tax is a tax on financial speculation, which would dampen such speculation, but would also bring money back to instruments of governance. Because what many governments have done, they've lowered taxes within their own society, they've therefore created problems for supporting welfare institutions. As a result, they've sold bonds on global markets and they've got themselves heavily into debt. We should be looking for a global taxation system which recovers some of that debt. Some of that should go back to attacking poverty on a global level, I think. Financial markets also need to be more transparent. They need to themselves be more democratic. The position of the IMF needs to be looked at. There's a whole package of measures, I think, which are possible. Going back through governance, the same thing applies to the United Nations and global governance. We can have, I think we should aspire to, your generation should create, I think, what David Held, the political scientist, calls cosmopolitan democracy. Cosmopolitan democracy will be democratic institutions which don't stop at the nation state, which go down below the level of the nation state and go up to the level of world society. It is not an impossible aspiration to have a global democratic system. It must surely come in the next century, and we should try to make it come. Attacking global poverty is probably the most difficult of the three issues I've mentioned, but I think a combination of financial regulation, increased mechanisms of governments, and the sorts of taxation, even if it's not a Tobin tax, which are possible, will allow us, in combination with other mechanisms, to eliminate the fourth world. We've in a way eliminated the first, second, and third worlds because now they've all merged. In the next century, what we should do is to eliminate the fourth. We can do it, and I think, therefore, I'd like to leave you at least this year with the idea that let's look for inspiration in politics. Let's try to make the values of enlightenment count in politics, and let's try to make them count on both a local and a global level. Thanks very much, and look forward to seeing you next year.